Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. You know, I was absolutely sure that we were going to wake up this morning, and it's Tuesday morning, so much smarter than we were yesterday about the state of the presidential election. But we actually know less this morning than we did yesterday, which is really saying something, because as I said in my newsletter, this is, and by the way, pardon my language here, but this is a clusterfuck for the ages. And I have to say that this is one of the first times when I actually had come up with an audio bit to do on the podcast, but I decided not to do it. Do you remember the scene from The Wire where the two cops go into the apartment, and the entire scene is them just dropping one F-bomb after another? And that's what I felt like to do the hot take on Iowa. Figured, you know, maybe not such a good idea. There are so many hot takes, and we are joined, remarkably, for the very first time on the Bulwark Podcast, and I'm not quite sure why we haven't had Robert Trzynski, on the podcast before, one of our regular contributors to the Bulwark. So, Robert, welcome to our world.
Glad to be here at last.
You do your own podcast, so you're kind of a ringer here. Just want to warn people that you actually do this. So
yeah, I do a sort of occasional podcast. Okay. It's not like an everyday thing. It's more like once or twice a month. Do interviews with interesting people. I call it Salon of the Refused. It's sort of trying to find voices that are very much outside the mainstream.
Well, we're all outside the mainstream these days. I mean, we are the contrarians. We are the. I don't know about you, but I mean, I'm a political orphan, and I'm very comfortable with this. You know, there's a lot of people who are saying, well, you know, if you're, you know, a Trump skeptic and you're no longer a Republican, you must be a Democrat. And I'm like, no, not me. I'm not going to go from one tribe to another tribe. And this seems like a rather notably bad time to become a Democrat, since they appear to be in the process of completely cracking up. So should we start by dunking on Iowa or,
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the old saying, democracy is the worst system except for all the others. And I think the Iowa caucuses really show that.
Yeah, but are we done with Iowa? Can we now definitively say that Iowa's reign is over, that this is just an epic screw up of such magnitude that everybody's going to go, yeah, we're over that whole caucus Iowa thing?
Well, I'm actually more skeptical that we're going to get rid of that, because, you know, politics is very conservative. And the problem is everybody wants to change the system because when it produces a result they don't like. But then it doesn't get changed because it would produce a result. The change produces a result somebody else doesn't like. And actually, the ironic thing about Iowa is they changed the system after 2016 because the Bernie people were upset that it didn't work well for him. And politicians are always fighting the last war on this sort of thing. We change our procedures because we didn't like how it turned out in 2016. And then we get a totally different bad way for it to turn out in 2020 because we changed things and we made it more complex, and we felt we needed an app for some reason. So I'm skeptical that we're actually going to change, but I'm also skeptical of how important Iowa ever really was. I think that as political obsessives, you know, we think, oh, Iowa is really important. But if you look at the results, you know, the person who wins Iowa hasn't always, and actually pretty frequently, has not won the nomination. It's really been significant because it's the first thing we get to report on as political obsessives. It's the first thing we get to comment about and say, oh, here's a result. But I don't know how significant it really is, you know, for the actual larger race. The only function it really usually performs is to winnow out the field a little bit. So a couple of people, like, you know, if we actually had results and had gotten them in a timely way, we might be able to say that somebody like Amy Klobuchar, you know, she's from Minnesota, she ought to do well in Iowa. If she doesn't do well in Iowa, she, you know, there'd be this pressure on her to drop out. And that's not going to happen this time. That's the difference I see.
Yeah, but by the time people listen to this, they might be releasing some of the numbers, but I don't think it changes this overall narrative. We're going to get to, you know, who the winners and losers are, but, you know, you make the point that we have been obsessing over all of this, which has always been ridiculous, that you have these Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire with the outside significance. And, you know, just remember in 2012, Rick Santorum barely sort of won the Iowa caucus. And then 4 years ago, Ted Cruz won the Iowa caucus. We kind of know what happened. You know, you made a couple of interesting points there. A lot of people are going to be focusing on this dysfunctional app, which was clearly a complete foobar. But also the way in which they did change the rules in order to accommodate the Bernie bros. So in some ways, what happened last night may actually be worse than it looks because it's systemic. And I know you saw probably Amy Walters' thread, which I thought was really interesting, from the Cook Report. And she said, look, this is the latest example of an institution literally collapsing in front of our eyes. And one big reason: the party has ceased being an organization dedicated to protecting, propelling the interests of the party. She says the Democratic Party has become a vehicle that anyone can drive. The rule changes demanded by many in the Sanders camp after 2016 helped make this process way more complicated than it can handle. And these changes were driven by representatives of a candidate who does not define himself as a Democrat. He's a proud Democratic Socialist. And by the way, a Democratic Socialist is a socialist. This isn't unlike Donald Trump's ability to completely hijack the GOP. The party does not have an identity outside of the president. This is interesting. So we have this absolute, I don't know, you know, how many different, you know, terminology for train wreck, foobar, snafu can we come up with? But it is a disaster. So I guess the question is, we still have to analyze this in terms of winners and losers. And frankly, I feel like we could play a game where we could sort of go around the table and you know, I'm going to assign you to say that Pete Buttigieg was the big winner. And so who do you think was the big winner? Or no, I'm sorry. Who do you think the winners and losers? There's obviously, I don't know if there's a big one.
Well, I think, you know, the big loser is Iowa, obviously. But I think the biggest loser is whoever actually won. And we don't even know who that is yet, but whoever actually won, because, you know, the point of Iowa is not that this determines the nomination. You know, as we've gone over, people have won in Iowa and not gotten the nomination, but it gives a big publicity boost to whoever's in first or second, and says, you know, especially if you're unexpectedly in second, you weren't considered a major candidate, but there you are in second. It's a big publicity boost. It gives you momentum. It gives you name recognition. It gets a lot of people to look at you as a viable candidate. Nobody's going to be talking about that because they're all going to be talking about the mess up. And that's going to be the narrative and not who actually won. So there are some people saying, well, Pete Buttigieg did relatively well. Supposedly nobody can verify that, or, you know, they can't confirm or deny that. But supposedly he did really well. That could have given him a big boost. That's not going to happen because we're all talking about what a mess it is. So that also explains why I think the big winner here is probably Joe Biden. Because the indications are that he was not going to do super well in Iowa. It would have created this narrative of Joe's old, he's out of touch, he's lost his step, he's weak, he's a weak candidate, somebody else can overtake him. That would have been the narrative if he were, I think he was ruled not viable, quote unquote, which is really, you know, harsh when you think about it.
Really not harsh, viable. Yeah.
You know, not viable is a really bad narrative for his campaign. Nobody's going to be talking about that. So I think he's the big winner out of this.
Okay, so this is a little bit of cognitive dissonance, and I hope people understand this point. So that if, in fact, Pete Buttigieg, which I don't think he did, but let's say he won the Iowa caucus, so he would be the big winner, except he becomes now the biggest loser because he doesn't get, having spent all those millions of dollars and the incredible effort that went into this. I mean, it's just, and what an extraordinary story this would be. I mean, this would be a slingshot, you know, a la what happened with Barack Obama in 2008. And yet because of the screw ups, he doesn't get that bump out of it. So in that sense, the winner becomes the loser. So Bernie Sanders in the same way. And again, by the time, people listen to this, we may have the numbers, and the conventional wisdom is that probably Sanders is going to finish in first place. Not, maybe not by a big margin, but in any case. And the narrative was supposed to be, you know, Iowa is burning and the Bernie was surging. And that was, you know, a pre-written narrative. Oh my goodness, here he comes. And if he wins in Iowa, then he wins in New Hampshire, then you create this incredible dynamic. And the only way you stop him is by this really messy cataclysmic, you know, battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. So he didn't get that bump. Bernie didn't get the bump either. So, that's a significant moment. So you mentioned that Biden is one of the winners in part because it looks like he did so badly. I mean, he had a lousy night, it looks like. The assumption is that he was fourth.
Right. And, we have no actual numbers, but that's the assumption, yeah.
So, and apparently he really underperformed even his polling numbers. So, you could say that he dodged a bullet because we're not right now really talking about all of this. Now, Jim Homan over at the Washington Post, though, says he sort of has a, you know, different take. He said the bad night for Biden is very good news for the other moderates, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and Bloomberg. You know, I mean, Klobuchar could have been knocked out of this race, you know, had they not screwed up. Who knows?
Well, I don't know if you noticed, Klobuchar had the presence of mind before all the reporters went to bed, before a bunch of us gave up and decided, you know, forget it, I'm going to wait until tomorrow morning. She had the presence of mind to go give a press conference and talk about how she outperformed it. She had, you know, there's no basis for her saying this, maybe basis in internal polling, but just makes the claim because who can contradict her? And it was a brilliant thing. She grabbed more airtime than she's gotten up to date.
I thought so too. And everybody is dunking on Buttigieg for sort of declaring victory. And it was kind of a, you know, it was kind of a bold move, a little bit of chutzpah there. But, you know, considering that the only significance of Iowa is what spin you can put on your viability, you know, really, why the hell not? But again, let's go back to Joe Biden here. You know, I mean, the core message is electability, but clearly he did not consolidate support, and now you're not getting the winning wing of the field that you would have hoped. You know, one of the anti-Bernie narratives would have been that after Iowa, you would have the moderates begin to coalesce around someone, presumably Biden, and that's not going to be happening. So, Buttigieg and Klobuchar and Bloomberg move on absolutely unscathed here. So could you argue that they are winners as well in that sense?
I think they are in the sense that they don't get, you know, if the ones who wouldn't have done really well in Iowa don't get winnowed out. And I also think, you know, that is a hit to Biden in the sense that if you assume that their voters are the people who are going to then go over to him rather than to Bernie. And I think that's probably the case. Certainly with Klobuchar, and I don't know who a Bloomberg voter is, so I confess myself being at a stump by who those people are. You know, it's not, I think the Yang voters, I think the interesting thing is everybody pretty much agrees that the Yang voters aren't going to anybody else. They're totally their own little weird group that are just brought in by his personal charisma, and if he goes, when he's out of the race, they're probably just going to go home. But, you know, some of these other people, I think they're more likely to go to Biden than to Bernie. So a winnowing would help him in that respect. I think he's really got to depend on South Carolina to come through for him. And that be the winnowing, you know, Super Tuesday and South Carolina. And those to be sort of the winnowing moments that take some of these lesser candidates out of the race and bring their voters over to him. But, you know, if I could predict any of this, the current somebody else would be in the White House.
Well, exactly. So Jonathan Last has a piece up on the Bulwark where he goes through and argues that you know, the obvious winner here is Donald Trump. We'll get to that in a moment. That all four of the candidates are diminished in some way. All four of them, you know, really have been hurt. And also the you know, in this post-Iowa apocalypse race, does seem to be more toxic. And, you know, I'm looking right now at Twitter and the hashtag Pete the Cheat is trending. I mean, you cannot really underestimate the toxicity of the Bernie folks out there. I mean, they are bringing almost a Trumpian level of nastiness now into the Democrat. Does it seem remarkable? Are you having a little bit of PTSD flashback to 2016 watching Bernie?
I wrote a piece for the Bulwark about that. I think last year about how I think, dear Democrats, I've seen your Bernie bro future, and basically talking about how, you know, if Bernie surges and if everybody's expected to line up behind him, how it's going to play out. And it's going to be an exact repeat of how Donald Trump took over the Republican Party, that all the moderate Democrats are going to be required to become Bernie bros or else. I think that is a real, there are definite parallels there. Now, I want to say, though, it's not entirely a new thing. I think it was Chris Matthews. So I'm talking at a thing at University of Virginia of last year, and he had some interesting things to say, because, you know, he's a guy, he's on that end of the spectrum. He's a quote unquote liberal. Apparently he's been to every Democratic Party convention since he was 12. So he has this sort of insider's look at it. And the thing that he said that I thought was really interesting was, he said, the battle in the Democratic Party, especially at the conventions, the battle is never Democrats versus Republicans. It's liberal, it's progressives versus moderates. It's the far left, and there's a whole wing of the Democratic Party that doesn't really care what else happens as long as they beat the moderate Democrats. And I think the Bernie bros are that group that's been there for a long time. They are that group of people who, they don't really care what happens in the general election so long as they beat down, you know, the wishy-washy moderate.
They really don't care what's happening in the general election. I mean, so that would also suggest that they're prepared to do things even if they know that it might re-elect Donald Trump. Because, of course, this is the narrative we're being told, that Democrats are really, really, really focused on beating Trump. You're suggesting that the Democrats are focused on beating Trump, with the exception, perhaps, of the Bernie ideologues.
Well, I think that, let me back up a little bit. I think that the approach to this election, there were two different approaches. There's the one approach, which is, we have to beat Trump, and it doesn't matter as much who we beat him with, just as long as we have somebody on our side, somebody who agrees with our values, who comes in, it's going to be better than Trump. Then the other approach is to say, well, look, Trump is so unpopular, such a repellent personality. Everybody hates him so much. And by everybody, they mean everybody in my social media bubble. Everybody hates him so much that it's a guinea we're going to beat him. So the whole thing is to use this as our opportunity. He's such a weak candidate. This is our opportunity to get a full out and out socialist into office finally, and to achieve dominance in the Democratic Party. And I think it's reinforced by the fact that these people also tend to be, as we say today, extremely online, meaning they are on social media all the time. They're fighting all their battles on social media. And the thing about, we learned the other term is filter bubble, right? So you've blocked everybody who disagrees with you on social media. So what you're getting is this echo chamber of people who reinforce your own views to you. So you assume Donald Trump, everybody hates him, we're clearly going to beat him, that's not a real risk, so therefore we should use this as our opportunity to get everything we've always wanted and go, charging straight forward to utopia.
You know, I was actually listening to some interviews of some of the voters from Iowa, including the Bernie supporters, and it really was struck by what you just said there, the degree to which they live in a bubble, and they don't really understand how some of Bernie's positions will play in the general election. And let's face it, the friendly media is not vetting Bernie Sanders, is not vetting Elizabeth Warren. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going to be coming after August that they have no idea. They've never heard it. They've never been, flagged on it. And it's just going to be like, whoa, where did this come from?
Have they heard about Jane Sanders and Burlington College? I mean, the basic stuff like that, they probably haven't even heard of.
Or the Russia stuff that's going to be coming out. So let's just go back to now, Jonathan's point about Trump. And by the way, this is so weird. We're sitting here in the middle of the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. He's giving the State of the Union address, and it just doesn't seem to be like, remember when that used to be a big deal? Remember when that used to be the Super Bowl of American politics? But he's pointing out that, look, everything about this caucus helped Trump. The Democrats diminished their own field. His most difficult opponent tanked, which would be Biden. If in fact you buy that, the fact that his fourth place, although I take your point that the fact that we don't know about it may, you know, takes the burn off that. And the argument that Democrats can't be trusted to run large operations was made in the most public way imaginable. And that is, boy, that is a powerful meme. You know, these are the people that want to run healthcare. They can't even run a caucus. You may not like to hear that, but you're going to be hearing that a lot, right?
Well, this is the launch of Obamacare. This is healthcare.gov all over again. Remember that opened up in 2014. Yeah. And again, it's a giant thing, the whole success of which depends on an app. It depends on a computer program. And you don't have the program tested, you don't have it properly built, and the whole thing fails right out of the gates. It's that same thing over again. And yeah, it's a great, you know, as the sort of being on the more libertarianish end of the spectrum, I'm like jumping up and down saying, yeah, this is why government shouldn't be running important things. You know, it's a great example of that. And you know, and partly because, you know, we got this mess because of all the things that government tends to do. So, you know, they made the rules more complex because somebody put political pressure on them. And they hired it out to some no-name firm because probably when we dig into this, you'll probably find that somebody had a friend and they wanted to give a contract to their friend. And they didn't test it out because they were going with a fly-by-night firm and the people running it had no, you know, the people who made the decision to give it to that firm had no technological knowledge or credentials or, you know, didn't know who they were hiring or how things should be done. You're going to find this is like a microcosm of why government shouldn't be doing important things. If it can avoid it.
Yeah, no, and no kidding. That is a powerful, that is a powerful narrative there. You know, people who think that they can do all of these things. And by the way, I don't want to get into this in great detail, but, you know, since I'm sitting here in Wisconsin, there's also this breaking story about the host committee for the Democratic convention here in Milwaukee that is a complete cluster. They've just suspended the director and the director of operations because of the toxic work environment. And, an unacceptable and upsetting environment. The host committee leaders are under investigation. These are the folks tasked with raising $70 million for this Milwaukee-hosted Democratic convention. And apparently, at least based on my quick read of the story, it sounds like they're from New Jersey. And they're giving all these deals. Like, yeah, that's a brilliant idea. Who thought that would be a great idea? You know, you're having a convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Let's bring some mooks from New Jersey in here. So this is the Democrats. This is not a good look for them.
I've got that line from my cousin Vinny. Yeah, like you blend.
Exactly. Yeah. You guys, you're from out of town. And you're from out of town. This is really not that hard.
And it's feeding that narrative, too, of the Democrats being the party of the coastal types, you know, the people coming and jetting in from New York and New Jersey and coming out into the heartland and going on safari in the heartland and not really knowing the area and the people. But which is strange because the upper Midwest is full of Democrats, you know, it's the old union towns and that kind of stuff. Right. So it's full of Democrats. They should be able to find local people to do this.
You would think so. And I'm sure that Wisconsin Democrats are thinking that right now. OK, so let's actually pivot to other things.
By the way, Charlie, in case you don't know, I grew up in Illinois. I'm from the Quad Cities. So, you know, right across the river from Davenport. So this traveling circus is something I've seen before.
So you know what it's like to be out here in flyover country. So I think you understand this, that one of the phenomena that I don't think that the Democrats fully understand is the phenomenon of the anti-Trump people, folks. I was actually thinking of writing a piece called, you know, Springtime for Anti-Trump. And anti-Trump is are people who, and I think you know these people, right?
Yeah.
This is ringing a bell with you. You know, it's people who will say, well, I'm not for Trump. I'm not going to defend Trump, but I'm going to dunk on the people who are excessively critical of Trump. You know, in other words, that which you immediately pivot from having to actually defend Trump's character, his behavior, or you know, whatnot, and attack either somebody in the media or somebody politically who has been unfairly or excessively critical of Trump. And this was really kind of a safe parking place for a lot of folks who had been Trump during the campaign. You were there.
I was anti-Trump for about 6 weeks in early 2017.
Tell me about that. Okay, tell me about that.
I mean, I, Not formally in any way, but no, I understand. I was at the Federalist, which was for a while. They've become much more just pro-Trump.
Right.
But for a long period about that time, they were very, very, very much
the
anti. I think the term, Jonathan Lask coined the term anti-Trump basically to refer to Molly Hemingway and some of the other people there at the Federalist. But I don't know
who coined it, but they were almost the poster children for anti-Trump. Right. Okay.
Exactly. But the thing, now the interesting thing is over time, anti-Trump just became pro-Trump.
Right.
But I understand the temptation. Like I said, for about 6 weeks, I was sort of in that space because the criticisms of Trump, especially early on, were so over the top and so oftentimes so dishonest. And, it's a comfort zone. Actually.
Right.
I think a lot of
it's a good parking place. Yeah.
Well, it was a comfort zone in one respect, which is that a lot of people on the right, a lot of conservatives, and I consider myself more libertarianish, but a lot of people on the right, it's very comfortable for us to be criticizing the mainstream media, right? The mainstream media, they're terrible, they're dishonest, they get everything wrong. It's this very comfortable thing. We've been rewarded for doing it for our whole careers. So it's this comfort zone you can go to because there's always something, the mainstream media is always doing something bad. They're always doing something that deserves to be criticized. They're always saying something stupid. It can become a little nutpicking. That's a term that came out recently that I like, where you find the craziest person on the other side and criticize him because, the media is a big place. There's always somebody saying something vile that you can get outraged about. But it's a very comfortable thing to go to criticizing the mainstream media. But at the end of the day, that becomes an excuse. I went better than anybody else. I did a piece eventually for the Federalist called Anti-Trump. which was sort of like taking this to this. It's all
I need to chart it out here.
I wasn't even sure where you ended up if you were anti-Trump. But it's sort of I eventually got to this idea of like, why are we defining ourselves by being for or against this one person instead of defining ourselves by what we're for and by our principles? And that, if you can get into that trap of in the day-to-day media back and forth of reacting to the latest gaffe or the latest outrageous thing said by somebody on cable news, et cetera, and be reacting, be acting reactively against all those things and not grounding yourself in the real big question of what do I stand for? What do I want as an outcome here? And judging people and events by that standard rather than by reactively against whatever the latest outrage was that occurred on whichever side.
So you moved away from anti-Trump, but my sense right now is that as the election campaign heats up, particularly if the Democrats move hard left, that you're going to be seeing a lot of conservatives that will be their comfort place to go into. That even the ones whose conscience is revolted by Trump, to basically say, yes, let's talk about how awful Bernie is, or let's talk about how awful MSNBC is, or this person. And have you heard the latest thing that Ilhan Omar did? And that will be a comfortable place for a lot of, people who you might have thought of as Trump skeptics or some never Trumpers.
That's what happened in 2016 is you had literally a whole generation of people on the right, Republicans and conservatives and what have you, who had been trained literally for 20, 25 years to hate the Clintons, right? Hillary Clinton, Republicans and conservatives have been hating Hillary Clinton, regarding her as corrupt and horrible in all sorts of ways since 1992.
Yeah, we had marinated in that.
Yeah. And most people had come up career wise, had come up by in some way criticizing the Clintons. And so it was this overwhelming impulse to say, I'm in like Donald Trump, but I really, really, really don't like Hillary Clinton. You can't possibly contemplate the idea of Hillary Clinton in the White House. And that's what pushes them over. I think Bernie's a gift to Trump in that same way, that if they nominate Bernie, it's going to be a whole bunch of people saying a socialist who liked the Soviet Union. This is the guy, this is the bogeyman that they've been their whole lives and whole careers. This is the bogeyman they've been told you have to be worried about. So, of course, this is going to be, and this is also the narrative that Trump has been using, which is I'm the only one who can save you from socialism.
And my position is pretty well known, but that will work. with a lot of swing voters. I mean, that will be persuasive for a lot of swing voters. And unfortunately, I think they're not aware of that. Okay, so I don't know if anybody actually reads books anymore. But you know how most people in Washington read books.
Yeah.
You know, when the new book comes, what's the first thing that everybody does when you get a new book? You look in the index to see if you're in there. Well, so because I remember that you are in my book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. Do you know that on page 215? And it's very interesting.
I think I actually knew that. I see. I'm younger than you, Charlie. So I slightly younger. I'm not that young. But I'm in the age where I do a Google search.
Okay.
Well, and that's how I find that I'm in the index of your book. Yeah.
So. What's interesting about it is I have a chapter called Trolls and Flying Monkeys, which is the culture of intimidation on the right, and pointed out that even before Trump had locked up the Republican nomination, the pattern was set. And this is something you wrote in The Federalist. I mean, this is like from the myths of the past when people wrote in The Federalist about Trumpism. And what you wrote was, when they're not literally pushing people around, they dabble in blackmail and threats of retaliation. Trump's staff and surrogates smear the reputations of female reporters and campaign staff. He threatens to dig up damaging information on donors to rival campaigns. And Trump threatens to crack down on an insufficiently fawning press. So, yeah, that has not changed. So this is the other thing, is that for a lot of folks, it's just not worth it to break bad on the Trumpists because of what you get. And I think that if you haven't experienced the trolls and the flying monkeys, it's hard to explain the number of folks who go, okay, just screw it. I'm not going to criticize Trump anymore. I'm just going to, you know, pivot to anti Trump, because there is a lot of that. Most people, I think their default setting is to not be trashed and destroyed and excommunicated. And that's one of the major driving functions of factors on the right.
Yeah. I think everybody likes to have a home. Now, I think I'm a little different because I came out of the Objectivists, the Ayn Rand fans, and we're used to not being liked and we're used to not really having a political home, not even the Libertarian Party. And so I'm a little more used to the idea of not being able to be a down the line Republican and being outside of that. But I think most people are used to having a home politically and an audience. And, you know, part of one of the secrets of this business is a lot of people who pose as bold leaders are actually the ones looking for the bandwagon. And then, you know, what's the old thing? They look for the marching band and they'd go out in front and wave their arms and pretend to be leading it. So, you know, I think Rush Limbaugh is a great example of that sort of thing, where there were a lot of those people who weren't entirely comfortable with Trump. Maybe with Rush, I think maybe he felt more that he knew Trump and that had some sympathy for him. But or Hannity or people like that, where they saw a big movement happening and their urge was to go out in front of it. Or I get biblical about it sometimes and think, you know, this is their tribe and where you go, I go also. And so they feel they need to be part of this vast, this movement and have the validation of being part of a movement. And it's a very common thing in the politics business, even though everybody poses as a brave truth teller.
You're exactly right there. In fact, I was thinking about Limbaugh yesterday. Of course, he's, you know, in our prayers, given his announcement about.
I hesitated a little after I mentioned Rush, because I don't want to criticize him right after that. Yeah,
I was commissioned to write something down the road about his legacy, and it's going to be grim, and it's going to be very complicated, because I think it's hard to overstate his influence and you know, for good and for ill, everything that's happened with the conservative mind. So this herd of independent minds you're describing. So you were writing for The Federalist. So what happened there? So you said you were anti-Trump for 6 weeks. So what happened at the end of the 6 weeks?
Well, actually, I don't know if it was 6 weeks. What really happened was Charlottesville. And, you know, that hit me a little because I was local, but, you know, the whole very fine people on both sides comment. And that was just it. That was like, you know, I was in this mood, not so much anti-Trump, because it's the temptation, you know, the delicious temptation to criticize people for all the over-the-top things they say is so strong. But I was more in the mode of, let's get what we get, what good we can get out of this presidency. You know, let's keep an open mind. Maybe right. It won't be so bad. Let's hope for the best. You know, we'll get some, hey, Gorsuch looks like a good appointment, that kind of thing. And then it was his comments on Charlottesville where, you know, I call it the Indiana Jones rule, where like the easiest thing in the world should be to say that Nazis are bad. Right. So remember that there's a line in one of the Indiana Jones films where he says, Nazis, I hate these guys. Right. And, you know, the reason why the Nazis are the villains is because nobody has to explain that they're the villains. You don't have to show that they're the villains. The minute a guy shows up in a Nazi uniform, you know, he's the bad guy.
There's a certain moral clarity there.
Yeah. And so I call it the Indiana Jones rule that the easiest thing in the world, especially in America, should be to say Nazis are bad guys. And he couldn't successfully do it. And you could argue whether he was, you know, what his intent, exact actual intent was with that. But the fact that he could not come out and say these guys are Nazis and they're bad. He has to find some way to excuse it and to come up with some sort of fictional group of people who were there just because they love statues. You know, I'm local. I know those people. I was involved in the Tea Party movement in Charlottesville. So I know a lot of the sort of people who would be opposed to the removing of the statues, the Confederate statues, but who, you know, are not white nationalists. Those people weren't there. You know, that was not the group that was there. That was a total fiction in his own mind. And that was the moment that I said, there's waiting to see what you can get that's good out of this presidency is not going to work. This is a point where this is a total disaster and you need to remove everything you love needs to be removed from contact with this because he's going to take it down in some way.
And that played how at the Federalist?
Well, you know, I kind of thought it would be tolerated and maybe it was tolerated for about a year and then they fired me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, see, this is one of the things that you were saying that you were an objectivist. I'm describing myself as a contrarian, and I think it helps that I'm an only child. You know, to be out of the tribe. But I'm sure you were struck by the incredible irony, this projection that people who have been conservatives who have been critical of Trump have sold out. That somehow that we are doing it to advance our careers. And of course, the opposite is true because most of us have lost jobs, have lost income, have lost friends, have been expelled from groups that we were part of.
Exactly.
And the personal price is so sometimes it's just so dramatic. And watching the people who have literally, you know, gone along with all of this, the careerists and the opportunists and the way that somehow they've decided, well, you guys are the sellouts. Like, what serious bullshit, you know?
Well, there's a certain projection there and there's, you know, it's also very, the Trumpist style of things. It's everybody. And it is projection. It's the idea that everybody is as cynical as I am.
Yeah. And yes, everybody is as cynical. So there's a piece that you have not actually published yet.
I'm told it's going up on Thursday.
No, I don't want to steal your thunder, but I'm absolutely fascinated by it. There's, well, you know, one of the, you know, maybe the premier, pro-Trumpist turd polisher publication is American Greatness. And one of the extraordinary things about that publication is watching intellectuals, conservative intellectuals, basically abase themselves to find some way of rationalizing their support of Trump. We've talked about this before. But there's an extraordinary piece that appeared recently from a conservative English professor who I have cited in other books that I've written, Mark Bauerlein. Where he basically argues, not basically, he's written a piece. Let me just call this up here. Called the piece. And, you know, he's become very pro-Trump, but the title is, when will conservatives understand that it is not a contest of ideas? You know, and when I wrote my book, I was talking about the attack on the conservative mind and that there was something it was not so much anti-intellectual as just is the irrelevance of ideas, the irrelevance of thought in this new era. And here you have a guy who is a professor of English basically saying, yeah, you know, in the era of Trump, it's not about ideas anymore. It's about power and it's about jobs. And that's a really kind of a wow moment for those of us who have tracked the conservative ideas and thought over the last 40 years.
Right. And so we were talking about how, you know, this hasn't been great for our careers. You know, some of us lost jobs and lost opportunities. The biggest thing I've seen is a diminishment of the world of ideas in the right, that there are fewer publications that I can go pitch. I mean, I'm thank goodness for the Bulwark, because there are fewer publications that I can pitch to, not just fewer that, you know, are sufficiently open to anti-Trump ideas to consider publishing me, but just fewer of them, fewer that aren't just clickbait farms. So there's been this sort of like the grifters and the cable news shouters and the people running clickbait farms, those have proliferated, but the intellectuals who provided the basic ideas, that I see sort of wasting away among the Republicans, certainly among the conservative movement more widely. And, you know, this thing by Bauerlein really struck me because, you know, many, many years ago, I showed up at the University of Chicago right after the publication of the closing of the American Mind, you know, Alan Bloom. Alan Bloom was at the UC at the time. So it had this big impact, you know, and my idea, the culture war, as I remember it, when I was coming up in the 80s, the culture war was about great books and reading the great books and studying Aristotle and, you know, the radical thing on campus. U of C was kind of a last bastion of this. We had a bunch of these neoconservatives where you read Aristotle as if he really mattered. And that was the culture war. And it was like, you know, the people who were against Western civilization. And then there were the conservatives who wanted to preserve these great ideas and engagement with great ideas. And I think that's the culture war that was lost sometime in the 90s.
And remember how often we use the phrase, you know, ideas have consequences. I mean, this is really the kind of conservatism I was at the center of. My first several books were about higher education and these wars about the future of the liberal arts and humanities and everything. And at least for a while, you know, when Trump emerged, he was so clearly aggressively anti-intellectual. You did have the pushback among the intellectuals, you know, as you point out, you know, the National Review against Trump and everything. And yet here we're sitting here and Trump's takeover, the conservative movement is nearly complete. And it does raise the question. So what was that conservative intellectual movement? Was it just completely ignored? Was it just this thin layer of rationalization over something else? Why were conservative intellectuals so vulnerable to Trumpism?
You know, I think that's still an open question to me. I think there's lots of different things going on there. I think that, like I said, part of it is that there was a culture war that was fought in the 80s and 90s that was kind of lost. And I think some of these people, like Mark Bauerlein, who were on the front lines of that, I think they've become defeatist. I read that piece almost as like this plaintive confession of personal failure. Because if there was going to be a new wave of conservative intelligentsia, this is the guy who should have been creating that and having, you know, having all these young intellectuals following in his wake. And I think there's a sense that they failed at doing that. And so they've given up on the idea that that's something that should be done. And therefore, it's useless. I think that there isn't time that's going to be needed to sort of look for conservatism and for the right in general to look inward on itself and say, Where have we failed? What is it that we did that didn't work? My personal argument, it's a larger argument. I don't necessarily want to open the whole can of worms, but it's part of the reason why I don't actually call myself a conservative, because I think the word itself is a mistake to begin with. I think it makes it sort of, we're just preserving whatever's already here instead of defining ourselves in terms of the values that we're for. I always like to say I would call myself a liberal and a progressive if those words were used with actual meaning to mean pro-freedom and pro-progress. So classical liberal is sometimes the term used, but I think we should just reclaim it full on as liberal, because the left doesn't seem terribly interested in using the term liberal for itself anymore.
No. If they want to abandon it, I think classical liberal, we can pick it up. We can pick it up from the recycle bin.
Yeah. So, but the idea is that, you know, you have to define yourself in terms of here are the ideas and values that we're for. And, you know, what we think we've gotten is we've gotten conservatism in the non-ideological sense. We've gotten conservatism basically meaning things were better when I was a kid. And that's like a major theme of Trump, of what things that Trump says is that, you know, basically things in 19 – that's key to his hair, by the way. if you notice it. People say, oh, it's a crosshatched double comb over or this, that, or anything. I looked at an old picture of him in his glory days in 1978, and it's the exact same hair. It looked a lot better back then because he was younger. But I realize now he has the hair he had in 1978 because that was this high point where he was exploding onto the real estate scene in New York City. And it's like he has this idea, things were so much better when I was a kid, and he's always trying to recapture those glory days. And that's a kind of conservatism, but it's like the shallowest kind of conservatism.
Yeah, it is. Remember before the conservative intellectual movement really, I think, gathered momentum in the late 1950s, would Lionel Trilling describe conservatism as being just irritable gestures? And
yes.
It's just, you know, not just, maybe we're actually going back to that a lot of conservatism is not about ideas. It's not about reason. It's not about debate.
Yeah.
It's about tribal identity. It's about attitude and all of those things. And if you understand that, then, you know, everything falls into place. So that those of us who really did think that ideas have consequences, that this was really about a war of ideas, we were the ones who really didn't understand what was happening, that the conservative movement as a whole really was more interested in the irritable gestures, or more defined by the irritable gestures than by reading Aristotle as if it actually mattered.
Right. Well, you know, I conclude the piece that has not been published yet. The big conclusion I bring from it, though, is that the contest of ideas does not end, that it's still there. A lot of people on the right appear to have given up on it, but it's still there, and we're going to be there to pick up the pieces and keep going, because ideas do have consequences. And in the piece that Bauerlein writes, he quotes Margaret Thatcher saying, first you win the argument, then you win the election. And he says, no, that's not true. No, it's still true. You have to win. You win the argument, then you win the election.
I thought that was very interesting that he uses Margaret Thatcher. That he wants to set up.
Naive, you know, Charlie.
Yeah. And she's so weak because she's not about winning. She's not tough. The Iron Lady. You know, I didn't think I would live long enough to know when conservatives would not only reject Ronald Reagan but also Margaret Thatcher. And again, you know, Margaret Thatcher. First, you win the argument, then you win the elections. Which would seem to be obvious. So now what he's basically saying is, you know, you don't need to win the argument. You don't need to make the argument. You just need to win. And then what? I mean, that's kind of so what is the end game? So he said it's all about jobs. So, you know, as an English professor, what you smash mouth into the universities and you force them to hire conservative intellectuals who do what? What is a conservative intellectual who doesn't think that ideas matter? I mean, I'm just like, where does this go at a certain point?
Yeah, because at some point, the contest of ideas is not just a means to an end to get people to vote your way. It's also the means that you use to define what it is you're trying to accomplish. It's how you define what winning is. You know, how do you know if you've won if you don't know what it is that you want, what your end goal is?
And what is the point? Although maybe the end goal is not to actually, you know, do anything. It is to simply to defeat your enemy. If you can, if you can drive your enemy before you and listen to the lamentations
the
of their women.
Of the women. Yeah.
That's enough.
One of my favorite quotes, actually. But you know, if I were to name one thing that I think has been a disastrous idea in conservatism, it's been the idea of cultural populism. I think that's one of the things that really, because, you know, so the left has sort of economic populism. We're for the regular worker on the factory floor against the guys in Wall Street. The right has cultural populism. We're for the decent people out in the heartland, as opposed to those, you know, corrupt and immoral people up in New York and Hollywood. You know, Hollywood has the same role for the populist right as Wall Street has for the populist left. And there's always been sort of a coalition on the right of the serious intellectuals and then the people who just hate the media and hate New York and hate the elites. But that there's always also been a tension there, because if you hate the elites, if you hate the highbrow intellectuals, right, then there's this potential you're going to turn against the intellectuals on your own side. And that's basically what we saw in 2015, 2016, is people saying, who needs you intellectuals who just sit around and talk about ideas? You know, we've got a guy who's going to, that was really what But He Fights was about. It was, he doesn't sit around and talk about ideas like you wimps over there. He goes out and he makes fun of people, and he, you know, and somehow he insults people, and he, you know, that sort of lowbrow combativeness is what they wanted. And basically what that leaves you with, though, as your definition of what winning is we're going to insult liberals. We're going to own the libs. We're going to insult people on the left. And insulting people on the left and making them angry is the end goal. It's not a means to an end. It is the end. And I think that's sort of what we're seeing as the definition of victory in under Trumpism.
Yeah, I do not disagree with that. You know, you and I could talk for several hours here, and I'm really glad that you've joined us. This piece that we're talking about is going to appear in The Bulwark later this week by Robert Trzesinski, and you've had some great stuff about the sweet meteor of death, which we could have gotten into. And Robert's stuff is regularly featured in The Bulwark, and we absolutely have to have you back, Robert. So anytime
you like.
Let us make this a regular thing. So again, thank you for spending so much time with us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me on.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.